The Ocelli Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck Ocelli.
Yeah, maybe I'm the most underrated voice. Let's see. June 1, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. My mic is too hot. But anyway, here we are, Woden's Day, Wednesday, the middle of the week. So it is. Now, scheduled here in this hour, which I've just started about, 18 minutes late. Scheduled here in this hour was supposed to be author, researcher Jefferson Morley, also investigative journalist, etc. He has a new book out, and, well, not going to talk about it too much, but I'm going to grab it from over on the side because I was getting prepared to talk to him about it, but, yeah. Apparently, we're not going to do that today because he's not responding to my messages, even though I scheduled this with him, and his publisher sent me the book. Scorpion's Dance. Okay, The President and the Spy Master. The President, the Spy Master, and Watergate. Okay, by Jefferson Morley. Interesting book, kind of an odd black, red, white title. A title page, or should I say cover, not the title page. Listen to me being all screwed up. Anyway, the cover of the book, The Dust Jacket, has a black, white, red kind of thing going on, and black and white picture of the White House in a limo, good stuff. But we're not going to talk about the book because the author didn't show. Now, this is the second time I thought I had Mr. Morley scheduled, and this time, as I said, not only was he scheduled, but there was a hurry-up to send me the book to make sure that I had it. And I got it, you know, just in time to be able to skim through it. And, yeah. So here's the thing. Next hour, we should have Addy Ads with us. Okay. And I was already planning on doing an extra hour. But there was a big giant delay there after the Donald Jeffries show was live, which shouldn't have been. Because I should have went live right away, but all this confusion, attempting to contact Morley, and an attempt to scrape together a little live panel of general topics in the first 40 minutes or so of the show. That's what we're doing. Okay. And like I said, second hour, Addy Ads. Third hour, we're going to discuss the death of Kurt Cobain. Now, I have no idea how I'm going to package this podcast. I guess I'll figure it out after it happens and see who else doesn't show up. Yeah. But glad to have you along, you, the listener, that is. Anyway, we are in the live chat and all that good stuff at Ocelli.com. But again, if you're not here on June 1st at about 8:20 or 8:21, I guess, p.m. on the eastern part of what we used to call America, then I'm not live. It's Memorex, right? That used to be the phrase. Anyways, Nature Boy, are you with me or did you not show up tonight?
No. I'm here.
That is no reflection. Yeah, that's no reflection on you, the whole did you not show up. That is a reflection on what I'm getting lately. Okay.
It's live radio, man. It's booking, you know. Now you get a little taste of what I go through on a weekly basis, but, you know, it happens.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, it's so strange because there's been a trend lately of a variety. You know, it's not just the well-known guest who hasn't shown up. It's been others that I didn't announce that I thought would be interesting little surprises that I thought were just people of interest that had been on the show before that maybe some of them hadn't been on the show before. You think you're completely certain that they're coming at exactly the right time. They know the deal. They know the drill. They know how to use whatever equipment they're coming on with. And showtime happens and crickets.
Well, yeah. When you're over the target, you know it when you start hitting the flack.
Hey, you know, speaking of flack, I got a couple of things knocked off of YouTube lately. Did I even tell you about that in this melee of strange lately? Did I tell you about that?
The stripes? No, hopefully it wasn't some of the segues I've done on the Wednesday show.
No, I wish. It turns out, well, the first thing that came up was COVID disinformation, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, that in this day and age, that's an automatic disqualifier with AI. You know, say anything that's a truth that goes against the WHO or whatever three-letter global agenda agency they have out there, of course, you get snagged. Wasn't that one that you had a long time ago, though?
No. I had several of those. But the thing is, I took down some content and also stopped feeding every single show of mine, at least to YouTube, thinking, well, maybe they'll leave me alone a little. Now, YouTube's not a key distribution point either anymore, but it does suck when you don't have it, because then all of a sudden, you know, my choked out Google presence goes to almost nothing without the, you know, 1,000 or so videos that are up on YouTube, right?
Well, anymore, if you're not in the feed, you don't exist. And the sad fact is, you know, when you get cut from Google, I almost got Google and YouTube mixed up.
That's okay. GooTube is just fine. I mean, you know.
You don't even, we're on AM affiliates. You don't want to know my name for them. It kills numbers, man. It really does. I've heard multiple podcasters who have gotten erased from the feed, and their numbers go from big time numbers down to nothing. You know, 500,000 down to 7,000. Hypothetical numbers, but you know the scale that I'm trying to get across out there. I think that when you, in this day and age, when you're trying to speak the truth like we do here, whether the listeners, you agree or disagree, we do bring the truth out in honest perspectives. We're living in a time of universal deceit, and it's to be expected to be cut down. But the thing about it, and the thing about the truth, is the truth will always prevail. And you can't stop speaking the truth just because there's danger involved. You have to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. Not to take a subtle stab at some recent police activity, but when you're faced with the flak, you need to fly into it.
Oh, I know, but you got to do it with intelligence. You can't just dive forward and expect good results. I mean, sometimes that's your only option. You got to do it with a little intelligence, because people ask me all the time, why do you even bother to stay on GooTube? Because, you know, they're going to get rid of you. I go, yeah, I know, but I'm going to stay there as long as I can. Mm-hmm. So they gave me the whole, you know, you're discussing COVID the wrong way, because I discussed the propaganda element, which is a separate issue from the thing itself, right? So I took that. I said, okay, content strike, gotcha. I'm suspended. And that happened last week, and it's on an older episode. So it's not the AI grabbing it, because the AI will grab it in 10 minutes from its upload. I know that. That's why, you know, a lot of people go, why do you write such cryptic show notes? Because that's why. Because the AI doesn't know cryptic. Okay?
Not yet.
Not yet. So, right. So that's why my show notes are vague and weird sometimes. It's because I'm asking a question as opposed to making a statement. That's why that stuff looks weird. All right. And it's not just GooTube, by the way. Other things will catch you. Apple now has an AI that'll disqualify you. So does Spotify. So does iHeartRadio. Mm-hmm. Right? If you really hit the thing the right way, they'll just knock you out in seconds. You'll just finish seeing your stuff upload, and boom, it'll be hit. Yeah. So anyway, this didn't happen. Now, months ago, there was a discussion about the propaganda element involved in pushing, right, the vaccination. Not about the vaccination, but about pushing it. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't argue. I said, all right, fine. Then another one came up, same kind of thing. I said, uh-oh. And these are old videos, so this is coming from, this is human. This is somebody either directly complaining, flagging me personally. You know how they go, did you find this offensive? Do you see a problem here? There are questions if you put a negative comment on stuff now.
Guilty,
right?
guilty until presumed innocent.
Right. So, all right. So I took the second COVID hit. Was, we're not going to give you a strike this time, but realize we're removing your content. You violated the guidelines. You want to put in a protest here? You want to put in an appeal? And no, I clicked no, right? Because not going to win that. The last thing, though, the third one, because these always come in threes, and I'm telling you, it's because somebody is going through my videos and complaining about the content to YouTube. The last one, guess what it was? It wasn't COVID. I'll give you that as a hint.
Were you bullying? Let me guess, please.
Sure.
You were bullying Epstein.
Well, no. That was a year and a half ago, maybe.
Okay, so yeah. What happened now?
A year and a half ago, I did get a cyberbullying strike for talking about Jeffrey Epstein. No kidding. Mm-hmm. But no, that wasn't it. Although I did mention it in the appeal to this particular hit. Okay. Because I said in this thing, I said, you know what, you guys hit me for self-harm promotion when I was comparing speeches of John F. Kennedy and you wouldn't listen. I said, you somehow described me as cyberbullying a dead, well-known, infamous celebrity. That's what I said. Infamous celebrity, which is a fair statement for Jeffrey Epstein. And that is true. That's what they did. But no, it wasn't about any of that. The third hit comes from, get ready for this one. It comes from, you're going to love this.
What?
Pushing the election, the stolen election narrative.
Oh. Are you serious?
Pushing the Donald Trump was robbed in the election narrative.
Well, I could tell you right now, this whole episode tonight's going to get canceled if that's the case. We got Addie on hour two.
Yeah, I know.
And we're going to be talking about the Georgia elections and the shenanigans, or that's not the right, what's going on with those. So
You just tried to combine skullduggery and shenanigans.
Yes,
it's
thank
okay.
you. I stumble on my words sometimes. I don't have the gift of gab that you have, Mr. Chuck. I would really wish I did.
It's all right. Okay. Really, it's all right. It's not a benefit. Ask people that got to live with me.
I'm here.
Yes, you are here, Chris. Hold on a second. We have Chris Graves with us.
Mr. Chris. No.
The last thing in this little list before we get to Chris is, I am somehow supporting the stolen election thing. Now, it was the weirdest thing because you'd think maybe it was a discussion with Addie in the past or something like this.
Mm-hmm.
Nope. I was talking to Terry Tapp. Now, let me ask you a question. You're a little familiar with Terry because he used to be a very regular guest on the show. Do you think for a moment that Terry Tapp or I was sitting there on Trump's side of the stolen election narrative in a discussion?
No. I mean, no. Nobody is safe to be canceled when it comes to that. I mean, a little side story. Sorry. Go ahead. No,
let me stick with this
stick with it.
Terry Tapp is a far leftist.
Yeah, he is.
He has no use for Donald Trump, and you know what? We can entertain the idea, and I definitely entertain the idea that you can't have an election stolen from you people because you don't own it to begin with. Oops. But Terry Tapp supporting the stolen election thing, and I'm supporting the stolen election thing. I can tell you that, you know, in general, I would say that these things are not legitimately counted anyway, but am I on the side of the narrative that goes with the 2020 election theft? No.
You're on the side of truth.
So, look, I sent him a message which contained the whole cyberbullying thing that we just talked about. How do you cyberbully a dead man?
Sure.
How do you promote suicide by talking about John F. Kennedy's speeches? I said, you know, I just listed all this stuff, and I said, I'm pretty sure that either the person reading this stuff and trying to judge this stuff doesn't understand nuance or doesn't understand English. So do whatever the F you want with it. And that's literally what I wrote to YouTube.
Good. Good response.
All right. Yesterday. And today I got a response that they've decided that in this way I have actually not violated their community guidelines.
Oh, you mean you got out of YouTube jail, Mr. Chucky?
Not YouTube jail yet.
Oh, you're still in YouTube jail. Oh, Chucky, you need to kiss the big butt of YouTube. Those big G. Those things look like a big butt. You need to kiss that with your tongue a little bit so you can get accepted and get out of YouTube jail. Okay,
you gotta do the alphabet.
God, you are in an odd mood tonight, aren't you? teenager boy.
I'm always in an odd mood. I just mask it well. Sorry about that.
I know. And this is definitely the unplanned, 40 minutes of the show that we're going to do here. Like I said at the beginning, Jefferson Morley was supposed to be here, but yes, we'll find out what happened with that later. Not happy, but like I said, it's going quite according to the trend as of late. But in what would have been the third hour, but now will be hour two and a half, I guess. Chris Graves is going to talk to me about Kurt Cobain, and we might have some interesting stuff to say there. And I'm not going to preview it here. Actually, I just invited him to join us so that we could bounce around a couple of other ideas and things that have been discussed in the ether. So, Chris, welcome. Glad we got you via Skype for the first time, because usually we got you on the phone.
Yeah.
You might be a little louder and clearer. So how you doing tonight? We'll give Nature Boy a break. And are you drinking some alcohol, Nature Boy, by chance?
Alcohol?
You mean tequila? Jackie, why are you judging like that?
Tequila counts. I was just curious.
Does? Well, then guilty as charged, man.
And the black tooth grin.
It's been a while since I talked to Mr. Tequila. Me and him are good friends. Me and Jose, not good friends. But there's all sorts of other tequila friends to hang out with.
That's true. Cuervo's not bad, though. Not bad. All right. Well, that means that while I let Chris start to talk, maybe I will grab my my proverbial bottle of Jack and say to hell with it. Have a couple of drinks during this melee that's going to ensue that is my radio show tonight, because I'm just in about the effing mood as it is. Who knows? Maybe third hour, we'll just forget about our language restriction that I usually keep in place here and say to hell with it, and it won't go out to the AMs and the FMs. But I don't know. We'll see how we survive the next hour and 25. Chris Graves, how you doing, man?
Yeah, I'm doing okay at the moment. Yeah, no. I'm sorry to hear about your guest. Yeah, that's not the first time, I believe, right?
Well, it's not the first time with him, first of all, but it's also not the first time in the past couple of weeks. It's like every other day, honestly. Somebody's supposed to show up that doesn't show up.
Oh.
And that's a weird trend for me. I usually don't have that.
It's just common courtesy, you know. I guess that's out the door now, too.
Well, you know, people got different ideas about what it is they're doing, and I know some people are busy. I mean, you know, I know Morley's busy. I know Dylan was supposed to be on a couple of times. Dylan Wade was a regular on my show. I was going to bring him on because he had just gotten on the Young Turks for a little bit there, doing his advocacy bit, and I wanted to discuss it with him. There's a legitimate left-winger I was bringing on the show. But I don't bring too many of them on. But, he was supposed to be on, and he blew me off, and I know why he did. And the reason why he blew me off for tomorrow I get now, too, by the way. Let's see. Thursday, do I have a guest for Thursday? I don't even know if I have a guest for Thursday at 8 o'clock. I'm getting confused between my cancellations, Chris.
Yeah, didn't you have a JFK researcher, too? Was it Jim Diogenio or what? Someone?
Diogenio was a while ago. He blew me off twice and gave me lame excuses about blowing me off twice. So now I will not invite him back to the show.
Yeah, he had like a sock drawer emergency or something.
It might as well have been. I mean, the one time he's telling me, I just plain forgot. But he didn't even bother to plain forget and respond to my messages or my or whatever.
Forgot to apologize.
Like 5 days later, he's like, right, I forgot.
Right.
I'm like, dude, there's no way you didn't check your mail or your email or your other messages by now. Yeah. You know, you just blew me off and didn't give a crap. And then the next time, you know, everything was fine. I checked with him a day or two before, like I usually do. Hey, don't forget. Yeah. Okay. And then crickets again. And then like 4 or 5 days later rolls by. Oh, my girlfriend was sick, so I just couldn't make it. And I'm like, you couldn't have told me, huh?
thanks for the heads up. It's not like I, you know, don't have sponsors or listeners or, you know.
I had zero sponsors at the time.
Well, that's not the point.
But you know what's funny is I did 2 hours with no break.
Wow.
At times. So this guy was supposed to be there for 2 hours with no break and didn't show up at all. So, twice.
So who needs him? You're better off.
Well, you know, I mean, some people, you get to hang out with Oliver Stone. You figure I can just, you know, piss on everybody else. Anyway, look, forget it.
Yeah.
Okay, just saying.
Well, anyway, the thing in the news is the Texas debacle, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of brought me back to some of my Columbine research that I kind of put off to the side for a while just because, you know, after a while, one topic kind of, especially something that's that dark, kind of just, you know, you kind of don't want to dwell in that world for too long. But it just made me think about it again. And I actually, go ahead.
Yeah, no, please. Because you know what? The thing about this is, I just listened to Don Jeffries, of course. You were listening to that show, too, commenting on this. And here we go again, right? Me getting out of shape. Why? Because, look, I understand where Don is asking certain questions, and he's right to. But then when he gets into this area of like, well, oh, you know, you're suing people for free speech and you have a right to ask questions. Okay, yeah, you do. But there's a difference here with this where he goes, well, I don't understand. What about the JFK assassination? I mean, why isn't the Kennedy family? I'll tell you what. I waited and held my tongue and really bit it during his show because I didn't want to go on the mic with him. The first couple of minutes when I was just hoping Morley was going to show up here and he was late, I was talking to Don after the show.
Yeah.
No recording of this. I'm sure if somebody asks him, he'll tell you it's the truth. I said, Don, listen, I'm going to put a nasty thing to you right now. And I want you to think about this carefully. If somebody was to say, okay, because his brother just died, that has shook him up pretty good.
Yep.
And, you know, he's getting better off it. But, man, we know that there's some trauma there. And it's connected to a point that he's making about vaccination and stuff like this. So if somebody was to come at him and start saying online and start writing him messages and letters and also doing radio shows that effectively said, okay, I want to look into Don Jeffries' brother's death. He might invite that. He might not say anything about it. He might say, okay, go ahead and independently investigate. Perhaps you'll find that the cops did something wrong, that the EMS did something wrong, that the hospital did something wrong, that maybe somebody slipped in there and actually harmed the guy because he's connected to Don. Who knows? I'm just imagining out of thin air.
Scenarios. Okay. Yeah.
So let me give you another scenario. Your brother didn't exist. You're a liar. As a matter of fact, you're a fraud. And here's the thing. You're using this to make your political point, which is about the conspiracy theory. Don't you know people are dying of COVID? Right. What kind of scumbag are you? Now, you know these aren't my words. I am just trying to put it to you that if you get 1,000 of these people coming at you, you might want to sue the person who's got the bullhorn. Right. You might get upset. You might think that it's over the line. Asking questions is one thing. Going after the man as a fraud about a personal situation, declaring that his brother doesn't exist or he's a crisis actor or he faked his death or any of this other stuff, you might see it a different way.
That's strong,
now, I put that to Don. He can respond to it any which way he wants. He did respond to me off air for a minute. I don't know if he took my point, but I was just trying to make the point that, you know, and he's like, but I'm very careful about, yeah, but it doesn't matter that you're careful, Don. What I'm saying to you is that when you say, well, I don't think it's right that people should be held accountable for this stuff because speech is free. Yes, speech is free until you actively start to do something. Now, he's right about the fire in the theater thing. It was made up by somebody who wanted to shut down dissent.
Right.
But at the same time, does that mean that I'm freely allowed to say, let's get our pitchforks, go to Don's house and burn it down?
Right.
Well, if I encourage that and then people do it, that might be a problem.
That's not, it could be,
You know, that's not, well, my free speech was to say that we should just string him up. You know, and this is not the way to go.
So, well, part of the free speech is that if you are responsible for something, then you're going to be held accountable as well. So you have to be careful with your free speech.
Well, you have to be careful with it only in as much as you got to realize that there's consequences still. It doesn't mean that it's consequence free.
Yeah.
And you know, again, in the legal system, consequence, right? You don't adhere to something. And look, and I'm not a fan of this either, by the way, because I think it's overused and people will use an overreach to take statements and just simply apply them a certain way and ascribe certain things to you.
Right.
And I think that that's over the line. And about political correctness, I mean, people have gone way too far now, you know, where it's like, you've actually injured me because you tweeted. Shut up.
Yeah.
You know, like.
Pendulum went the opposite direction than from like the strict conservative stuff. Yeah.
Yes. Now, and there is a point of being a civil libertarian, and then there's a point of being reasonable. And I'm just saying that these lines are not always clear to everybody.
No.
Okay, because in a technical sense, to say that, you know, if I was to make those statements about Don and be serious about him, you might say, well, that's his free speech. He can say that. True. But if people start acting on what I'm saying, because I have a public forum to act in and almost anybody can get one.
Right.
You could be encouraging actions from people. And some people would say, oh, well, you can put out whatever you want.
Not exactly.
Well, in a way you can, but the thing is that maturity, there's a problem with maturity. If people weren't moved by an idiot with a microphone sometimes,
right?
Okay, then it's okay, but it sounds like I'm being a hypocrite because it's almost like I want people to do things or think or take action. Yes, but I'd never encourage anybody to do any harm in my mind. Now, are there people that could say, well, what about the harm you're doing to, easy early targets, the Bush family. Okay, so the Bush family could take it personally. That I've said that they're, you know, war criminals and really the mid-level managers of the elitists who are out to murder us all. So they're basically the grand accomplices in the public face of it. And they could say, you have been harmful to our family. You have put our family in danger. They have put themselves in a position
where they would be. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So, and there you go. Now, are we going to have a point at which, well, you can't make those kind of statements, you know? Well, if that's the case, I mean, there's a whole lot of people that, you know, have called every corporate, you know, and corporate people are generally scumbags, especially if they're making a lot of money.
There's a reason they got there.
Yeah. Take your pick of a target. I mean, what? Jeff Bezos? Okay. The Koch brothers? Okay. Whatever. All these people that are
Walmart, you know, people.
Yeah. Right. The Walton family. You go attacking them and you call them part of the elitists who are actually out to murder us all and poison us all. Well, you know, you are making some harsh statements. but
you can actually kind of back it up with even just mainstream media, you know, news items. You know what I mean? But these families are not known. They're not publicly known usually, you know. So they're not put, except for the ones that do press conferences, which is weird, especially after a loved one just got murdered. That's questionable. But for the most part, these families don't do interviews and they're not putting themselves out in the public spotlight, you know. But these politicians, that's kind of comes with the territory, you know.
Well, you know, that's true. And, like, you got families like the Sacklers, which, by the way, I jumped up and turned on my air conditioner in case you just heard all that noise. It's hot in here. Okay.
You just had a house that was struck by lightning, right?
Well, that's the other thing. Don brings that up, like, every show now. I love that. It's funny. He's like, let's hope the show doesn't get struck by lightning. I mean, every show, if you notice, he slips that in
there. Yeah. Blasphemy.
Dude, listen, all of a sudden I'm in the dark and it's just loud boom, dark.
Wow.
Okay.
So I wonder what you were thinking. You're like, oh God, what was I talking about the night before?
Well, I'm not one of these guys who thinks, I'm not important enough for God to aim a lightning bolt at. So
I don't even mean God. I just mean, the powers of be.
Yeah, but who's going to use that kind of? I mean, listen, a bullet only costs less than a dollar. I mean, who's gonna use the directed energy weapon on dumbass me?
There you go.
Anyway, no, I didn't think that. It was just like, damn.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, but when the lights go out, I do sit there for a minute and assess the situation. What can I hear? What do I actually see? Is there any light source? I sit cool for a minute and just take it in.
It can be kind of peaceful too, actually, a blackout.
Well, that was the next thought, is that, wow, it's actually
drain your brain.
except for the noises I hear in the other room, like, why is the power out? I hear that in the other room, but all the other noise of the house has stopped.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
It can be refreshing.
It kind of was. But it wasn't to Don, who's sitting there still talking to his guest and not knowing what the hell happened. Anyways.
I was just bummed that your show wasn't on that night afterwards.
Oh, yeah. Listen, no power, no internet in the area. And it was like historically crazy lightning storm over Macon, Georgia, that just was hitting the ground everywhere. Just lucky me. I mean, really, I should have bought a lottery ticket.
Powerball.
Yes.
You have Powerball in Georgia?
Yeah, we do. We do.
Oh, okay.
Although, yeah. I think I got to do that after the second lightning strike, so let's have another one. Although,
first time's a charm.
That does remind me, I could spend a little time just having this, and I'm just having a fun conversation with Chris right now. In what will be the third hour, we're going to talk Kurt Cobain, but I might have enough time to tell you about the time that I actually did get struck by lightning.
Yeah, go for it. I thought you were going to talk about the time that you met Kurt Cobain, and then I was going to be like, come again?
I absolutely never met Kurt Cobain.
Did you ever see them in concert?
Not in person, no.
Okay. So lightning strikes.
Yeah, on video the next day, yes. But I never saw them. I was never like in the place with them at any point.
No.
Anyway, I wish I had.
Freddy Krueger was. Oh, now that you just jogged my brain, when I went and met Robert Englund for like the eighth time, I asked him, my one and only question was, did you ever get to see or meet Kurt Cobain? Because, Kurt had the famous photo of wearing the Freddy shirt and everything with his arms stretched out.
Yeah.
And then I also asked him if he met Layne Staley of Alice in Chains. And he didn't know who Layne Staley was, but Robert Englund, the guy who played Freddy Krueger, his nieces and nephews, I believe, brought him to a Nirvana show in like 1991, 92 in Portsmouth, Oregon. So I always found that to be really kind of cool because I'm a big fan of both.
That is very interesting. I would not have thought that of Robert Englund either, but
yeah.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's cool. I appreciate it, though.
He also was with Kane Hodder, too. Jason, I saw him personally. I saw him at a ICP show up on the balcony, the VIP section, because Kane Hodder, the guy who plays Jason, he's a huge juggalo. So I guess he just invited Robert to go. And that was a weird, odd sight, too. That was in Worcester, Massachusetts in 2012, I think, 13.
Nice.
Anyway, go on. Sorry.
Nice. And I have not been to a gathering of the Juggalos.
I was invited once, but then the guy stole my identity, so I was like, yeah, I'm good.
Okay, but I did want to go, but I didn't go. It was like one of those things, I don't have the money. I think it was out in Pennsylvania or something, or was it Ohio?
That one in Ohio in a field or whatever, and they had their own security and stuff.
Yeah, that one I was supposed to go to, and I didn't go. That's what it was. It was Ohio, and it was in some damn field.
And they had like Bobcat Goldthwait, and they had that other girl, the rapper girl up there getting like crap thrown at her, literally like poo from like the outhouse, whatever. It was like a famous clip.
I heard about this stuff, but then that was also at the same time, I think the FBI was trying to prove that they were a gang.
Terrorist.
Like a terrorist gang.
It was like right after it. But yeah, you're right.
Yeah. And that wasn't what kept me from going. I just didn't have the money.
It's expensive.
It was expensive to go to Ohio and try to feed yourself for a couple of, it would have been a couple of days in that field, I think, like 2 days.
Exactly. Yeah. You're camping out every day. Yeah.
So I needed to have, like, you know, something to camp with. I don't have a vehicle because I don't drive. So, you know, a bunch of things. Yeah. So it was like, I need, like, I don't know. I calculated I need like $700 that I can throw toward this, and I just couldn't put it. So I didn't go. Kind of regret it. Anyways. But there wasn't nothing I could do. I couldn't raise the $700 in the time I had. Otherwise, again, would have went. So anyway, no, I was actually at one point struck by lightning, and I'll try and tell you the story of this really quickly, because I brought it up on Aaron's show, and I thought I had told the story on Aaron's show of being struck by lightning, but I guess not.
I haven't heard it before, and I listen to his show sometimes.
Yeah, okay. So anyways, here's the deal. I'm, let's see, what class, how old was I? That makes me 13. Yeah, eighth grade. Okay. So 13 or maybe even 12. I might have been in seventh grade. I was in a school where I was there for seventh and eighth grade, and I was living in a place called Manasquan in New Jersey. Anyways, there's an apartment complex there next to a place called Peddler's Village, and I lived there. It's the Atlantic Manor Apartments. And there were, let's see, one, two, three. There's four buildings, okay, that are all the same. These brick face kind of, you know, apartment complexes you see just about anywhere. So standardized kind of place. But in the middle of it, in the middle of these four, there's like two in the back and two toward the front of the road, right? And it actually has its own little road that you drive around to get to all the buildings. And, you know, two outlets on the driveway. Okay. Just to give people an idea. But in the middle of that is a field. Almost looks,
it's funny, but it just sounds funny.
Well, in the middle of it is a field, and the thing about the field is it looks like somebody planned on putting another one of these buildings in that field and never got to it, right?
Right.
The way it is. And there's trees, you know, here and there. This is not like the most urban of urban areas. This is like a suburban apartment complex where, you know, you got some landscaping and stuff, right?
Yeah.
And they have square sidewalks that go around these, like, sort of square U-shaped buildings where the apartments are. And there's an upstairs apartment, downstairs apartment. Okay, you get the picture. Anyways, I'm standing on one side of this field, and it's pouring rain, and we're standing at one of these overhangs over the little stoops or porches, depending on how it is you want to look at it, for the apartments, right? Each one of these stoops is generally accessed to four apartments, one up, one down. Okay. And then one up, one down on the other side. All right. So we're standing there, me and a bunch of kids, and we're talking, and it's just pouring rain. And that field, when it poured, used to flood a bit. So I don't have my shoes on because it was just like, I can't remember why I didn't have my shoes on, actually. But I didn't have it with me. Anyway, so I go to make a run to go get something because I live in building number one and I'm over by, like, say, building number three. So, you know, I'm a good distance away. And like I said, in this field, you could easily place another one of these apartment chunks that I don't know how many it would contain. Let's see, 4, 16, 32. I think each one would contain like 48 apartments.
Right.
So a brick building that can hold 48 two-bedroom apartments. Okay, that's the size of the field there because you could put another one of these there. Okay. So I start to run across, and I don't know what happened because the next thing I know is I'm on my back sliding in about 3 inches of water in this field. Now, I felt something happen, and I definitely felt like my body just end up vertical as opposed to horizontal. I mean, another way around. Horizontal as opposed to vertical because I was running top speed through this water in the field. And, of course, I had just been spoken to about, you know, not being the tallest thing in a damn flat field, because that's how you get struck by lightning. And according to the kids watching me, that is precisely what happened. The lightning came down and hit either me directly or right the ground next to me. The lightning sort of spread out across the flooded water. On the
beach. Oh, yeah, that's right.
And I went down and just slid. And
I didn't feel anything?
But I could not move or anything. I was just greeted with the sensation of I'm now like sledding through the field because my forward momentum didn't stop, but my body just went, never mind. And that was it. Like all muscle function just failed at once, and I was on my back sliding through. Now, when I did finally get the wherewithal to sit up and everything, strange smell in my nose. I believe I smelled electricity. and I was not really injured at all, even for flopping on my back and sliding. And when I say I slide, I mean I must have slid a good 20, 30 feet. and I don't know if that was a push from the lightning or my forward momentum from running top speed.
No.
I do not know, but apparently I was struck by lightning when I was, about 13.
Wow.
And, weirdest thing ever, and it did not hurt.
You didn't become a Spider-Man villain either, apparently.
No, I didn't get any superpowers, but I did wind up on my back and not really sure. Like, I wasn't fully aware of how I got there, and there's definitely a blank space in my mind in between sliding that last 10 feet and where I was running. Like, I totally remember starting to run and getting about 10 feet into the field, but they said I was just about dead center in the middle of it, which had to be a good 100 feet away. Wow. From where they were standing, so 100 foot from where they were standing, it looked like either the lightning hit the ground around me or it hit me, and it dissipated across the surface of the water.
It was like a mudslide.
Well, I did have a lot of mud on my back because I literally slid through this entirely, completely flooded, muddy field. And there was grass too, by the way, but I just hit it just right and was like sliding on my back as if that's what I meant to do.
Yeah, that brings me back to the prom. Yeah.
Totally prone. And actually by the time I stopped sliding, I was pretty much in Jesus pose, like, you know, arms out, legs straight.
Like that was Chris Cornell.
That was the orientation there. So,
yeah.
Yeah,
wow.
And I don't know for certain that I was actually hit by lightning. I'm taking the word of the bystanders for it because I can't explain what happened. I was running
your
forward.
Your life didn't flash before your eyes? You didn't see the tunnel? Nothing like that?
No, I did see a flash.
Oh, well, yeah.
I did see a flash, but it was not my life going by. I mean, unless I, you know, missed it because I just saw a bright light for a second.
Yeah.
And definitely felt a sensation and a weird noise in my ears that was not thunder. I didn't hear the thunder.
Wow.
I just
you never had any kind of feeling after that, like that something was off or nothing?
No, the only thing that was similar to that is when I totally went to it's got to do with electrocution, obviously. When I was there, I had a bass that was not well grounded, and I went to a microphone and went to sing into the microphone, and an arc connected to my mouth and gave me however many volts you can get off of that. And that, when it hit me, now I stopped moving and stepped away for a second from the mic, but totally surprised I didn't fall down because I couldn't do anything else. But I did get kind of shock, and I remember that sound that came out of the amp is similar to the sound I heard.
Oh.
Maybe it wasn't coming out of the amp. Maybe it was coming out of my head.
Yeah, your eardrums.
Well, but it sounded like it was coming. It sounded like I heard this in the amp, I thought. But perhaps that was in my head because that's sort of what it sounded like when I was allegedly struck by lightning running through a field. So sorry. Look, we're actually through the time that should have been an hour, so I'm going to go get to Addy Ads. I'm going to let you go ahead and eat.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, because you better eat something. Charge up.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're listening to the Ocelli Effect at Ocelli.com.
I don't know, TJ. this is actually spoken in an audible voice to anybody in about 2,000 years. I think his last words may have been,
so a quick note there during the break. You guys heard something on the stream that we're not going to put in the podcast, but appreciate you for tuning in. This is the Ocelli Effect. I don't know what hour it is. I don't even know what day it is, but does it really matter? Nah. I got Chris Graves with me, and we're going to talk a little Kurt Cobain for about an hour and see where this rabbit hole takes us because, you know, I was definitely alive for this one. When one day, actually a couple of days after my birthday one year, I woke up to some crazy news, and that is that the biggest rock star on the planet had allegedly committed suicide. And he was now part of the 27 Club, and I don't know, MTV might have went live all day with updates on it that really went nowhere. I guess the radio, everything was consumed with the death of Kurt Cobain. Now, I had things to say about it at the time. And, you know, frankly, it's kind of good that it wasn't the internet age because I would have never lived down some of the harsh comments I made about the people freaking out over this. This was people of my generation, Generation Xers, flipping out, losing it. Because Kurt Cobain allegedly blew his head off with a shotgun, which already sounded weird. I mean, if you're going to kill yourself, I mean, a handgun, much simpler. And the idea that, you know, Kurt had had his problems, almost died not too long ago, had fallen into a comatose state in Rome and elsewhere, possibly, allegedly. He had the crazy girlfriend who was his wife, who they had a child, you know. It was a wild in public sort of life. Anyway, over the years, everybody from the guy who owned Sub Pop Records to private investigators to different members of the Cobain family to, indeed, the father of Courtney Love, Hank Harrison, who you heard on this show, who has passed away recently, recently as in the past few months. All had some interesting things to say about the death of Kurt Cobain. Today, I got Chris Graves with me, and he's going to talk about some of the stuff that he's found out, researching the case a bit. I might interject something where people have tried to personally drag me into this case and not to do radio shows, to investigate it, maybe with good reason, because I would have had some natural affinity and connection to certain things. But this hour's not about my point of view or what I found out. Chris Graves recently made an appearance, let's see, with Billy Ray Valentine, right? I can't remember. What is the name of his show, Chris?
The Infinite Fringe.
The Infinite Fringe, right, which is a video show. It's out there. Maybe I'll put the link in the podcast notes here, and maybe I'll give you some notes from Chris in the notes. But we'll see what happens when we put this out. Anyways, either way, Chris, how you doing tonight, and are you ready to talk about the Kurt Cobain death case?
Well, first of all, I'm just happy to be here, and I'm here. I'm happy to talk about this case anytime. I've been looking into it pretty much since, not when it first started, but probably around the time that Ian Halperin and Max Wallace's book, Who Killed Kurt Cobain, came out in 1998. Around that time, also the documentary Kurt and Courtney by Nick Broomfield, which got a lot of press because Courtney had her lawyers basically banned it from the Sundance Film Festival, if I remember right. So she did not want that out there whatsoever. So, and I've always been a huge Nirvana fan, a grunge in general, or just rock and roll. And, you know, like Alice in Chains, Nirvana, Soundgarden, Pearl Jam, not so much. But anyway, yeah, so I always found a lot of the details of the case really, really intriguing, to say the least. And actually, Unsolved Mysteries did an episode of it, too. And they kind of tried to say, oh, you know, this private investigator that Courtney hired, he's just basically out to try to make a buck. But if you really look at Tom Grant, the private investigator I'm talking about, if you really look over the years, he really hasn't, like, become a millionaire over this case whatsoever. In fact, he's brought up multiple times in interviews that the thing that kept him going for so long was he would get letters from, you know, teenagers that were going through tough times and actually were thinking of committing suicide because they thought that's what Kurt did. And unfortunately, well over 100 copycat suicides did happen after Kurt's death, which is, I believe, one of the main reasons why Seattle PD will never reopen this case, because then they'd be opening themselves up to all kinds of unlawful death lawsuits for sloppy police work or maybe even the corruption that they're known for up there.
Well, let me pause you on that, because, again, I remember this, you know, at the time, I studied the JFK assassination, but I wasn't alive for that. This I was alive for, and I remember the, you know, the reverbing sort of effect on, again, it's my age group. I mean, I was, what year was it exactly? It was 94 or was it
90? He died officially, the coroner says, April 5th, 1994. His body was found on April 8th.
Okay, so I'm exactly right that when I said I got the news of this, like, right after my birthday, because my birthday is April 7th. And yeah, it was 94. So there I am. I'm 22. And there was, you know, I still knew plenty of teenagers and stuff like that. And I knew, you know, many young adults, and people were seriously affected by this. Oh, yeah. And it was, you know, there was a big gathering, outside of his home in Seattle. There were other impromptu gatherings that occurred in other parts of the country, where people got together. There was, I remember mostly,
Courtney read the so-called suicide note too, over the loudspeakers at,
right.
Yeah, one of those, I forget the name of the actual place, but it was like one of the major stadiums up there.
Well, there was initially this sort of loudspeaker thing that was done, I think, at that gathering outside of the home. It was a recording of her, though. Yeah. It was just sort of pumped out, like, you know, by some big speakers.
And she added things during that speech that was recorded that were not in the note whatsoever either.
Oh, yeah, no, she's calling him names and all kinds of weird things during this reading.
She actually read parts of it where it she made it sound like it was a part of what he wrote. And I know what you're talking about. She had her little comments after here and there and everything.
But yeah, that too.
Yeah, it was kind of weird reading of a suicide note.
Well, right. And look, the whole thing was really bizarre, but the effect on other people is what got to me. And at a certain point, I mean, I wrote a letter to the editor for a music publication that was East Coast based, but certainly was going to feature in that following week, or maybe the following 2 weeks, nothing but cover stories on what happened to Cobain. And so they published my letter to the editor, which says, you know, that people my age need to concern themselves with themselves a lot more, because I was a known local musician. So it was like, you know, this is, by the way, how I got my first death threats. Thanks. By putting this out saying, you know what, this guy's a rock star. You don't know him. Fix up your lives. Stop being jerks. Yes. And I did not make myself any friends with it. You know, I literally said that, you know, Kurt Cobain ended his enchanted rock star life with a shotgun blast. And you people are freaking out for it when you had nothing to do with it. Stuff like this. I mean, I was hyperbolic in my statement, but I was frustrated. I was angry because people were hurting themselves.
Yeah.
And I don't know. You know, you say 100 suicides. I got to tell you, I think it's a low number. There may have been many more.
Those are the only ones that cited Kurt in any kind of note left behind. And a lot of the times there isn't a note left behind. So that right. is very low. Yes, you're right.
Yeah, and the next thing is that there was a lot of self-harm going on, too, that didn't necessarily lead directly to suicides, successful or otherwise. But then again, you got some failed attempts at that time, too. there were people cutting themselves and all kinds of stuff, even at that gathering near his house, cutting themselves, bleeding. I saw this myself, and I went, man.
Two of them actually went home from that vigil and killed themselves right then and there that day.
You know, again, I'm certain that you're not making that up at all. I consider it a low number. Again, I bet you there was more.
Probably, yeah.
You know, but maybe nobody knew that they were at that vigil. And that's what it was. It was supposed to be this vigil. It went on for a bit. And like you said, this weird reading where Courtney, yeah, added stuff to the text. And by the way, later on, I mean, that note circulated. You know, we all got to see it.
Because of Tom Grant. Because he tricked her into giving him the note to Xerox a copy of. That's
right.
The only reason that ever saw the light of day in the public.
I was just going to say that's where that note actually came from. And the weird thing about that is it was the copy of the note. Courtney, I don't think, ever let that note stay in anybody's hands long enough to make a complete. It was just a very bad copy of it.
Yeah, exactly.
And people have questioned the legitimacy of that note. I actually think it was the note. You know, like, in other words, I don't think Grant, some people accuse Grant of circulating something that wasn't real for a bit.
Well, it was Kurt's. The bulk of it was definitely Kurt's writing. Supposedly it was a retirement letter from the music industry to his fans. And someone added, a few lines at the end. And the one line, where he addresses it to his childhood, imaginary friend, Bada, that's been the stuff that was added to it.
Well, it's a whole weird thing because, again, a few years later when they published a full book of stuff in his hand, they literally just published the book with his handwriting in it page to page.
Yeah.
You see stuff that almost looks like maybe it was legitimate, maybe it wasn't. You don't know because he was inconsistent with the way he wrote stuff. And I got to tell you, I think it's one of those things where I would not, even if an expert told me definitively this is what it is, I don't know that they would be correct. It's very hard to tell what's going on there. But you know me, I'm always cautious about these things.
No, that's good. That's very good. But the only I agree with you. The only thing I'll add to that, just food for thought, Rosemary Carroll, Kurt and Courtney's entertainment lawyer, actually had Courtney's backpack at her house and invited Tom over because she actually has some suspicions about the whole thing in the first, in the very beginning as well. And what she showed Tom was that in the backpack was handwriting practice sheets, that she let him actually make copies of as well. And it was as if she was tracing these letters over and over again, every letter of the alphabet. And that's actually out there too, if people want to search it out. So I don't know why she'd be, trying to practice like different, you know, letters and stuff. So she, I don't know.
Yeah, no, but that's the thing is every piece of this, when you tear it open, there is a very strange nexus of things that come together. I mean, that's the most fair thing you can say, because no matter which way you go, okay, let's see. Courtney's definitely a strange character. Okay, put her aside. She could have her motives for saying whatever, doing whatever. So put her aside. Who knew Courtney? Who could observe what she was doing? Well, next you get her family. You got the nanny. You've got, you know, different people that are supposed to be their friends. And I question who the hell some of them are, to be honest with you.
Yeah, she ended up surrounding Kurt with all of her lackeys at the end. All of his real friends were gone by that point.
Well, except when he would allegedly run away and then go on a drug bender where he did indeed go around people that knew him.
Yeah.
Whether he was actually doing all the drugs that were ascribed to him or not, another story. But I do believe that they had an issue there. I mean, the guy wasn't ever trying to say that he had no issue.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, it was sort of out there in the public. I mean, nobody got into all the details of it. Look, it's an ugly thing when you've got something like that going on and the public wants to dig into it. But some of it was very out there and understood. Like I said, the whole thing that happened where he was in Rome and that problem occurred.
Yeah.
Still a lot of questions there.
Well, it's funny you say that about the heroin you're talking about, right? Like in his system and everything.
Well, the
blood work from Rome confirmed what he had said in an interview like about 6 months prior, that he was off of heroin and that he actually finally got a pinched nerve that was in his stomach. He had that condition finally diagnosed properly, and he was on medication for it. And the blood work apparently in Rome came back that he was telling the truth.
Well, there you have it. But a few months later, it's very possible for him to have gotten back into a lot of things. Now,
right.
And look, I'm not making any definitive statements here. I would say every.
Well, I'm glad you are. You're being open minded. I'm. It's refreshing.
Well, it's the best thing we can do from a distance, because again, every time somebody gets close to this, this is another thing. Every time somebody gets close to this, weird things start to happen. Okay. Yeah. They start to track down these very nefarious characters who are around, and they are all sorts of ugly, and God knows what's going on. I mean, everybody heard about Il Duce and this and that.
Yeah.
Let's put it aside, because everybody can go, and you can find Kurt and Courtney now, even though there was some controversy about it. You can get a hold of it. You can watch Soaked in Bleach.
That's the better of the two, in my opinion, because they don't even go with the El Duce stuff. Like, I don't even really pay attention to it either. It's definitely interesting that, you know, he passed the polygraph or whatever, but and the way he ended up dying is suspect, but I don't even, like, focus on that stuff.
Yeah, but see, just based off of a bunch of, like, individuals who I actually know, not necessarily the characters in play here.
Yeah.
I would say that it would not be strange for that guy to have died under odd circumstances regardless.
Right.
Because he was involved with things that generally make you die under odd circumstances. So, you know, but put him aside. Put all of it aside for a second. And Hank Harrison, who, again, was on this show, definitely made some strange statements over the years, and I would say that it's a valid thing to take a look at the tree when you're trying to figure out where the apple fell. Courtney is definitely a strange character, and I think I can say that with full confidence. You know, but either way, let's put it all aside for a second. And I remember the contentions about, well, let's track down what happened to the credit card. Was it being used after he was dead? And
nope.
All right.
Never resolved. Never.
That has never been satisfactorily resolved, first of all, which I find really bizarre because, frankly, I've known other people that have died and allegedly their credit cards were used hours afterwards and they're not famous. Yep. And usually the credit card company does not let up on that.
Right.
And because they want their money. See, because they're going to turn around and go, well, we can't charge a dead person for this. Up to this point, we can't charge Kurt's estate if he's already dead. So whatever's on there afterwards, and it doesn't matter if it's $100, by the way.
Exactly.
They go after it. Okay. So that's weird in and of itself, but I don't think it's the key here.
No, not at all. It's one of those things that you can, you know, cite, but I just not dwell on it, you know?
Right. So let's get to some keys. Because here it is, all right? And let's start with the circumstances by which he is in at the time of his demise. I mean, we can all agree it's not a faked death or anything like this. This guy's dead.
Yeah, he's dead.
I've never heard a contention about that, you know, so.
Some people try to put him in the Tupac is alive kind of deal, like on an island somewhere, but it's hogwash.
Well, if they're all hanging out with Elvis and Jim Morrison, that's cool by me, but at some point, I mean, do a Christmas special or something, because, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, please. But,
yeah, have Andy Kaufman, like, do the Elvis impersonation for Elvis in front of everybody, you know?
Why not? Let's bring it on. But here's the thing. I'm not going to go there. I'm going to assume the guy's dead, and here it is. Now, he's supposed to have used a shotgun. I know that people contended for years, you can't possibly do this. They're wrong about that. But when we start talking about the heroin and what goes on there, now, people talk about the minutiae of putting this stuff away and the way it was found, that's not realistic. I'll tell you that in various suicide scenes, you will find stuff like that.
Yeah.
That is consistent with reality. It doesn't necessarily make sense to the common observer, but sometimes that happens. And there are people that have made different contentions about the level of heroin in his system. Now, is this something to look at? Yes. I find problems with both sides of that analysis, though, because on the one side, people go with a very textbook explanation about the amount of heroin that it would take to incapacitate somebody, about the amount that could be in their system, and all that. Those things are not hard, fast numbers like some people think.
Right.
Because if you're an experienced, and I've been around, and I had an opiate problem at one point, never to the extent that I could take on probably the amount that they're talking about here in his system. But I've seen people who survive huge amounts. Even if you think back, and this is something documented in another documentary, totally unrelated, but there's a guy on the, what is it called? The Crime of the Century documentary, where they used him because he had been an experienced heroin addict as a test case for OxyContin being impossible to overdose on.
Right.
All right, so they were giving him 160 milligram OxyContin tablets, and those are pretty huge doses to begin with.
Yeah.
Okay? But this guy, because he's an experienced heroin addict, was able to build up to 5, 10, 8 of them.
Wow. Okay,
every couple, every 2 hours. Now, that would kill somebody if you went right out of the gate and started grabbing them and you ate, you know, 8, 10 of these. You might not make it to your next handful. And if you did, you might not make it to your third handful. So you're going to be done. Yeah. But if you're somebody who is accustomed to this, you can not only survive it, you might enjoy it. Right. You're not incapacitated. It is a reactive thing that is relevant to your tolerance. Now, that being said, did Kurt have a tolerance relevant to that? That would be something that you'd have to know some of the real history about what was going on. Now, as you stated, the blood tests and stuff that came back from Rome, They show some chemicals, but not the heroin.
Nope. It's the date rape drug, Rohypnol, that was Courtney's prescription from England.
Fair enough. And that's something, but it does show that chemical in there. Now, can you prove as to whether he voluntarily took it or not? Another issue, if you're doing an investigation step by step, just because it's in his system doesn't mean he took it himself. Put a pin in that. But also, if it's in his system, it could mean that he took it himself. And you know what happens in a lot of cases is people lie. Not only do people lie if they snuck a drug into somebody, but people lie if they took a drug and made a mistake. And or maybe there was a suicide attempt and they don't want to cop to it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So everybody's word is with a grain of salt, and you've got to investigate these things. Now, there are scientific ways to understand the levels at which somebody was taking things over a fairly long time period. You can do tests on certain parts of the body and determine at the level of exposure, even though, you know, the heroin you took 2 months ago is out of your system. There are ways of determining that you had a fairly high level of it at a certain point. Now, this is from the forensic side of it, but there's also just the common street level side of it, where, you know, there are certain people that can take huge. Let's move to another drug, cocaine. Cocaine for some people can kill them the first time they take it if they take a huge amount. Other people, they get accustomed to it to the point where, you know, their nose is collapsing. Okay. Yeah. They've been snorting it so long. They might be able to snort, you know, a line the size of the table that, you know, would get 7 people high.
Yeah.
Everybody's got different circumstances, and you got to take that into account. Now, back to Kurt's body. Is the heroin at that level where maybe it is seemingly superhuman according to the textbook, but if he has a tolerance, if he has an experience, he can be like the OxyContin guy who, telling you right now, don't try it at home, taking, you know, 7, 8, 160. I don't even think they make the 160 milligram pill anymore, not even today. Because it's too dangerous. But imagine that for a minute. If you're able to take, you know, 1,600 milligrams of OxyContin, okay, which is what, equal to 160 of those, say, Lortabs you get today?
Yeah.
160 of those, swallow them at once. Yeah, that's not going to do good for most people. But if you have a high, high tolerance, long experience, it might be grist for the mill. So, now that we have that in our minds, that it's not according to the textbook and it's circumstantial and it's individual, what level was this heroin at as it was detected? And is it in his bloodstream? Has it gone all the way through his system? or not. These things could be determined forensically. Do you know if they were, Chris?
Well, here's the thing. If one of Kurt's immediate family members requested that his autopsy report be released, they could very well do that, but they have not to this day. But Tom Grant, in his way, was able to find out that forensically it was three times the lethal dose of heroin.
But what are they calling the lethal dose? Do you know?
I'm not offhand. You got me on that one. I'm always saying that three times a lethal dose. I did know at one point, but I don't have it right in front of me.
Well, this is a number that if somebody was to be researching this for themselves, I think they should take a careful look at. Because, again, what somebody does consider to be the lethal dose, you got to consider the person that's telling you that. Now, there is a way to quantify that should have been done in a chemical analysis if they did a full toxicology run on him. Unless we have that document, and again, Tom Grant does the best he can, but we need that document in order to know really how far this has gone. And this is me again being objective. I'm not trying to kick the legs out from under you. I'm just saying.
No. You caught me off guard in a good way, and I'm actually looking it up for the official one while you speak. But I just wanted to add that another food for thought kind of thing. Nicholas Hofshorn was the coroner that did all the autopsy and everything, and he was an old friend of Courtney's and actually a roadie for Hole back in the 80s. And he ended up dying in a weird bungee jumping accident a few years after this. So I just wanted to throw that out there before I forgot.
Yeah, no, that's definitely interesting. Another thing to note is all around the country, people that are conducting autopsies are not always well instructed in forensic pathology. And B, some of them are not even doctors that are coroners in different parts of the country. They may indeed be appointed to that position. They may have some school on it, but a lot of them are way less than qualified than most people think. Okay. Now, there are some supremely qualified, absolutely ethical, perfectly objective, objective individuals in those positions. But again, you got to look at the coroner and who it is that's actually conducting the autopsy, what lab he sends it to. Everything needs to be examined here. So just saying, it would definitely do us a lot of good to know these things. And I've seen a lot of allegations made, some of them more substantive than others. This is just one of the things to consider in this circumstance, though.
Well, Seattle PD was an open and shut case of suicide within an hour, and they actually did a press conference from Kurt's driveway stating as such. And right. That doesn't seem to be a normal thing that they usually do. You know, it's not open and shut whatsoever because, like you said, they haven't even had, weeks to go by to do the forensics and everything. But they already labeled it right there in the press an hour after the body was found.
Well, toxicology almost anywhere in the country, and especially back then, was 2 to 3 weeks it would take for a full spectrum analysis to be done. So they didn't have the drug information when they made that statement. So there's one thing.
They also did not test for the fingerprints for a full month either, which there were no legible fingerprints found on the shotgun shells, or the pen that was sticking through the note. That was in the planter or whatever. So you got that as well.
Yeah, see, I was going to move to this next because now you have the shotgun. So, okay, is it physically possible? Is it theoretically possible for somebody to use this shotgun to do what Kurt did? It is. Okay, understanding his size and...
Well, that's... No. That's actually something I wrote down earlier. There was been a question whether or not Kurt was tall enough to be able to reach that particular shotgun as well. There's been question about that. I wanted to throw that out there too.
Well, but taking a 12 gauge with somebody who is less than 5 feet tall, it can be done. So I don't think Kurt was less than 5 feet tall.
No, you're right.
And, so I'm just saying, now it is awkward to do it.
Yeah.
okay? And there should be hallmarks of certain things, and I'm not going to go into it all, but there's a way to prop up that weapon and to reach it a certain way. You've only got to be able to get an arm's length down the barrel, okay? And if you have basically, you know, the barrel itself, if you can get your arm down there.
It was a Remington Model 11 20 gauge shotgun.
So it was a 20 gauge. Okay.
Yeah.
But even so, the barrel length, I don't think exceeds what would be his arm length. It could be done theoretically. Now, you're not going to be able to hold it properly. You'd have to prop it.
Right.
Okay. There's a couple of different logistical problems here, and that might result in certain things happening, including not having your best aim. You don't need all that much aim, though, if you're going for the head and you're doing this. I believe it to be theoretically possible, okay, physically. But do we have evidence that that's what occurred? Because the way that the shotgun winds up landing, now things can land in a variety of different ways, but the way that this thing ends up laying afterwards seems a bit suspect. What do you know about that?
Well, I know that the shotgun shell was on the wrong side of the body. Also, let me think. All right, what was the question one more time about
what
the shotgun?
I'm trying to say is where the gun ends up afterwards. If this is the thing that happened, if he shot
himself. Yeah, it's on his chest still, and he's got the death grip in his left hand, holding it still on the barrel. Mm-hmm. He has the grip, but from what they were saying, the shotgun shell ejected the wrong side of the body. From where it supposedly was supposed to be. Mm. But I don't focus on that either, because then you got other experts that say, no, it's physically, it could happen. It could be like a weird, one-off or whatever, where his arm twisted a certain way that it wouldn't normally twist. So, other than that, I don't really have anything else with the shotgun, besides the fingerprints and all that. Which, not just Kurt, but also Dylan Carlson, who bought the shotgun for protection. Kurt wanted it for protection. So Dylan Carlson, his best friend, went with him to go purchase it, because Kurt didn't want anyone knowing he had this lying around, because he was in fear for his life. And also the gun shop owner. All of them would have had fingerprints. They all handled that weapon. And you could say, oh, yeah, you know, maybe with the violence of the gun going off may have, you know, smeared them. But everything, the shotgun shells and the pen, and yeah, I find that hard to believe. I don't know. Maybe it's possible. But.
Well, look, a lack of usable fingerprints is a possibility. But you would assume somewhere there might be, because you're not – if you're – in the mode of committing suicide, I don't think you're worried about leaving your fingerprints. So there's probably going to be some grips there where you're going to leave a decent one.
Exactly.
So that is a fair question. But the thing about this death grip on the, on the gun, to me is, why is it his left hand? It seems to me as though, and now maybe I'm wrong about this, and this is just a speculation I'm coming up with here, but I would think that if I were to reach for the trigger and I had that intent, I might use my dominant hand.
Yes, you're right, yes.
That Kurt is left-handed, so I don't know if that's the way you'd end up with the grip. I mean, I guess it's theoretically possible, but that does seem
awkward. It would be like awkward. It would feel unnatural, in my mind.
I'm just thinking out loud here, but let's get back to the rest of the way things are.
Because there's quite a few other things here. Like supposedly his hair was neatly combed when they found the body. The electrician found the body. That's kind of odd. By the way, the shotgun, since it was purchased for home protection, and that's why it was a 20 gauge, so it wouldn't penetrate walls and hurt your loved ones if you had to fire it off. He had three shotgun shells were in that gun. So was he planning on missing the first two times? You know what I mean? Like, There's that, and the lack of blood. I'll tell you the lack of blood. There was one little trail of blood coming out of his right ear. That a lot of experts point to the possibility that his heart was already stopped by the time the trigger was pulled.
That's a weird thing because first of all, you would figure that a point blank range with a 20 gauge shotgun, there should be pretty much a hell of a mess.
Yeah.
And I know that in initial reports they were saying that, and somebody.
No, Courtney was saying that in the press, painting a gory picture about how his head was blown all over the room, basically repainted the room with his brains, all these gory things for Francis to grow up and read about her father. That wasn't true at all. His hair appeared to be neatly combed even.
Well, what was contradictory to that immediately was this picture where, which emerged at the time, where you could pretty much see his legs stretched out on the floor, but you could not see his head, and somebody had gotten that from an elevated position across from the house somehow. And I don't remember the full story on the photograph, but I know that this was what ran in almost every publication within that week. This picture, and I think they printed it in black and white only
at first. But yeah,
there wasn't they're just okay. I'm just saying that it looked from a quick glance like it was inconsistent. Would it be as messy as Courtney described it? No, but she definitely floated that out there, and it should have been, in my mind, more messy than what we saw. There was something very odd about this picture that somebody captured, and I'm thinking to myself, if you went to all the effort to get through the window there and to do this with a telephoto lens, it seems to me like you might have been able to catch another angle.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I don't know exactly where it was shot from, but whether it was a helicopter or a house or something, climb up.
No, it was the park across the way from like a tree. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, but it's definitely elevated, so, it looks to me like maybe it's a weird angle, and it almost hides the thing that would show us exactly what that scene was like, because obviously, if he was sitting, it seemed to me as though they were saying he was sitting on the floor, okay, because that's how he ends up there, and he just ends up back. It seems weird to me that he's not leaned up against the wall.
Yeah.
Which again would have led itself to, literally it would have painted at least that wall.
He was like 8 feet away from his heroin kit too, where everything was neatly put back and everything. It's just, I don't know, the whole thing just stinks.
Yeah. Well, neatly put back again. I've seen strange minutia where people have, cleaned up after themselves and then killed themselves. It's like, why are you bothering to clean your sink? You're not going to use it again.
That's true. No, I agree with you. Yeah, but going back to the photo thing, that photo was like the only one that was available publicly for years and years up until 2014, mm-hmm. when the Seattle PD they decided to do basically like, we're going to reopen the investigation just so we can close it again within like a week. And they actually had rolls of film that hadn't been developed in the 20 years, and they ended up developing it. And in all of those photos, too, there's no blood. There's no blood at all. There's no violence. It's very odd.
Well, that's the thing. It's too clean of a scene. Now, again, she describes a scene that is a gory mess. But then we got these photographs, as you said, 20 years later.
Yep.
And I don't know if they're still available on the internet because I haven't seen them in a while.
No, they are. Yeah, I saw it just to bone up for this.
Okay, fair enough. But again, it doesn't look consistent to me with a close range shot on a living head. It just doesn't.
I know.
Not with a 20 gauge. I mean, listen, if you told me this guy shot himself with a 38.
Yeah.
That's the kind of mess I see here.
Oh yeah.
And that's why I wanted to graduate from the initial picture, which only anybody saw that did not allow you to see the head.
His arm and his right leg with the shoot with the tennis shoe. That was it.
Right. Right. But when we got these other pictures, it's still very inconsistent. So from day one, we have something that's inconsistent. Now, Does that mean that the shotgun wasn't used? No. Does that mean that the scene was cleaned up? That's a possibility. Does that mean that maybe this didn't happen the way they said it? Also possible, because as you were stating earlier, if you don't have a live body, that's another thing. You're not going to
Your heart's not pumping the blood that would cause the goriness.
It'll cause a lot more goriness for sure. If you shoot a corpse, yeah, it makes a bit of a mess, initial splatter, but it doesn't continue to make a mess. I mean, I'm trying to not be too graphic about this, but I mean,
it's like the JFK thing. You kind of have to get into the gory details just to get to the truth, unfortunately.
Okay. So now that we've gone through some of this minutia and we've talked about the scene and we've talked about the strangeness of the suicide note, what is it that makes you think, what do you think is the biggest thing here that makes you say, look, something is rotten here? And where do you go with that? I mean, what is it we can make of it from the thing that you think is of the biggest red flag, so to speak, here?
Kurt wanted a divorce from Courtney. He wanted her taken out of his will. He actually called Rosemary Carroll, his and Courtney's entertainment lawyer, and wanted her to draft up a new will like a week or two before his body was found. And he also turned down Lollapalooza 94, which was worth $10 million, and Courtney was pissed. So if that's not motive for murder, I don't know what else would be.
Well, you know, and one could say, well, you know, and Chris, let me devil's advocate it for a minute, right?
Sure. I want you to, because, I might be wrong.
Well, no, but the better thing is I give you a challenge and you prove me wrong, and this way you can strengthen what you're doing. Exactly. Here's the deal, right? Somebody could say, well, look, man, Lollapalooza 94, he turned down a couple of things, actually, but that was the most notable.
He disbanded Nirvana, too, which a lot of people don't realize. It was actually in Rolling Stone magazine in March of 94, and it didn't really get that much press.
Yeah, because, well, there had been rumors about it before, so people took it as maybe it was another rumor. But apparently there was all sorts of points here where he was kind of like, yeah, I'm not really all that interested in doing this anymore.
He was worth more dead than alive.
Well, see, now you could say that, but then somebody could say, look, you know, Courtney Love is going to keep moving on because that's what she did for a while, moving from person to person, let's say. And she could get plenty out of Kurt even without Lollapalooza 94. She could get plenty out of his estate. And she definitely had a foothold on him if she kept the baby, right? Because there is Francis here.
Part of the reason why she hired Tom was not exactly to find where Kurt was, because Courtney already knew where Kurt was, because Callie, the nanny, her ex-boyfriend, who was also a junkie, I was keeping tabs of Kurt when Kurt arrived back at the house on April 2nd. So the day before she even hires Tom Grant, she knows exactly Kurt's movements. And Tom Grant was theorizing that the reason why she wanted him to do surveillance on all these drug dealer, establishments, I guess you could call it, was to get dirt for the a possible pending divorce.
Uh-huh.
As cheating or whatever, because then any kind of prenup would be null and void in that situation. So,
well, and he may have indeed, there are allegations not proven, but there may have been a possibility that he was starting to drift a bit.
And she was too. The reason why he was in Rome mm-hmm. was because he actually had a note that she confirmed on audio tapes that Tom Grant still has. She confirms that he wrote her another note, in Rome saying he was leaving her and he was going to take Francis and leave. Mm-hmm. And she kind of just casually says it like, oh, it was nothing. Oh, that's Kurt's way of joking around. But when they found Kurt's body in Rome, she didn't call the ambulance for like 3 hours while he was like passed out. And the way he was dressed was he had his jacket on, his sunglasses. He had a wad of cash in his hand as if he just grabbed it and was about to go out the door. So, yeah, I don't know. This is all kinds of things.
Yeah, no, there's plenty to dig into here, but
No, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, Chuck. No. The reason I brought that up is because he was leaving her because at the time he found out that she was cheating on him with not only Billy Corgan but also Evan Dando. That's a big reason why he was going to leave her, and the fact that she kept getting scarier and scarier when he would turn things down like Lollapalooza '94.
Right. I mean, look, there was a lot going on here, and he started confiding in more than one female friend, and they're always described as female friends. But, you know, you get into these sort of circumstances, you don't necessarily know the total of what happened. I mean, unless people are really recording you all the time. So there's this going on. She's clearly having, you know, and those are the notable names. But, you know, I've heard stories about other things going on. Okay.
Well, yeah, she also claimed that she slept with like Trent Reznor and Maynard from Tool, and they're both like, we wouldn't touch her, you know, to save our lives, you know. I tend to believe that.
Yeah, well, look, so briefly I worked for Trent Reznor, and
Well, give me some insight there. You think he was just BSing?
No, I don't believe for a second that Reznor would have engaged with Courtney Love. He was a strange guy, yes, but kind of
not that strange, right?
Yeah, no, let me put it to you this way. He would have seen her as really like a filthy sort of monster,
right?
So he was a very, very interesting guy. I consider him to be a musical genius, and
so I'd get along with him then if that's how he feels.
Yeah, I mean, but but that would be a good reason why she would want to. I'm not saying that she wouldn't have made an effort to try and do that, but a couple of years later, earlier than this, when he came back from California after he had rented Charles Manson's house, he went to New York for a little bit. That's when I worked with him. I don't for a second think that Trent Reznor, I don't know what he would have had to have been. He would have had to have been in the middle of a mental breakdown to sleep with Courtney Love, knowing the way he was. And I know people say, well, that's the guy who hung out with Marilyn Manson. Yeah, but Trent Reznor is a weird animal.
I've hung out with people, too, that turned out to be, you know, not the best people to be associated with. But you don't know sometimes, you know.
No, I'm not saying Trent's a bad guy, but he's just too strange to be doing. Like, he's too strange in a different way than to be floating with her. Right. That's all I'm saying. All right. Anyway, back to this, though, with Kurt and what was going on. Sure, divorce. They had a toxic relationship. I mean, most people would say, oh, they were both into the drugs. And, yeah, okay, that's part of it. But there was actually.
She got him hooked on heroin in the first place. A lot of people don't realize that. And also, shortly after they started dating, she pulled like a Yoko and got pregnant pretty fast. And that played on Kurt's background, being a child of divorce. The only reason he married Courtney is because he didn't want his child to end up going through the same exact thing he did, which he was devastated as a child when his parents divorced.
Yeah, which is and he winds up spending a lot of time with his aunt who one of those documentaries, she's sitting there playing tapes of,
Kurt and Courtney. Yeah.
Yeah. And I really appreciated that little insight, but it gave you an idea that, the guy had his, issues as far as family structures go. And he figured, well, you know, let me try and do this right. And I can sympathize with him there because, kind of did a similar thing myself, but anyway, bad decision if you, but either way,
He also, one other thing before I forget, he also, people did not want him to leave the house, at the end of his life because, number one, one of his cars, someone moved across town and put a for sale sign in. And the other car that was still on the property was his Volvo, which was literally right underneath the greenhouse in the garage. And all four tires on the Volvo were slashed. And that's actually why Kurt contacted the Seattle police on April 2nd. A lot of people don't know this, but it was in Melody Maker magazine, their issue right after he died, that he filed a police report that can't be found to this day. So is someone that's in fear of their life all of a sudden suicidal? I don't know.
Well, look, it is theoretically possible, but again, there's a lot of incongruent things going on here. You know, one could say, well, look, you see what happened with Scott Weiland and him running around and him doing his thing. I get that. And some people don't understand the world of, you know, somebody who has gotten themselves into a situation where they're heavily addicted to something and they're having these issues and they're being chased around by people in their own lives. This happens to way more than just rock stars, I assure you. Yeah. And the thing is, that's sort of introduced as the justification for why it is all these things are so weird, right?
Yep.
But I don't think it explains it. It just doesn't. There is too much going on here. Yeah. And the problem is, again, we got to go back to the situation. You know, let's first break apart the scene. And like I said, even with those photographs that were released, and some of them are kind of useless, they're even a little strange as far as crime scene photographs go, because
some of them are posing. Some of the cops are posing in the pictures.
Yeah. Which
they did not take this serious whatsoever. And here's the other thing. Detective Cameron, who was the head of homicide, was also buddies with Courtney and actually told her to burn the note from Rome that Kurt wrote saying he was leaving her. Why would you tell her to burn the note? And he says, quote unquote, that this will do nothing good for you or your family.
Well, and that's the thing. In a realistic sense, let's just say all things are above board and it is as it is, right?
Yeah.
Why would you have to get rid of so much
anything.
Stuff that
anything
has gotten rid of?
Yeah.
Because exactly. It's very weird. A whole bunch of things disappeared, not just by Tom Grant's words, but by other people's words who say they saw certain things that no longer are there. You know,
the guy that most likely, in my mind, actually killed Kurt, and I won't even say his name, but I know people that are familiar with the case will know who I'm talking about. His father was paid by Courtney very shortly after to tear down the greenhouse. So nothing is left to reinvestigate.
Well, see, now that's what I was going to ask you about. We don't want to give the guy's name. That's fine. But
I met the guy, and I took every fiber of my being not to get very, very, very angry.
Well, tell me what it is that leads you to believe that this is the guy. I mean, because, again, there are so many strange connections here. There are a bunch of characters that are not necessarily the headline. Yes, indeed, there are drug dealers. Yes, indeed, there are opportunists. There are people hangers-on to Courtney. There are hangers-on to Kurt. There is this orchestration of people in his life that sort of isolated him from most of the people that he considered to be his friends. There's a lot of weird stuff going on here. And tell me how it is that this one guy stands out. I mean, give me the key piece.
All right. Well, the key piece. All right. Well, number one, he was the only one in the house with Kurt on all the days that he was supposedly at the house. He had the credit card, too, by the way.
And he had the credit card, too. Quick question about that, because there was a search done in the house.
Yeah, and it was all nice and tidy and clean, which is not how Kurt and Courtney lived their lives. They were kind of messy and piggy. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, I'm thinking, did the parties involved incapacitate Kurt since he had all kinds of bruises and puncture marks on the inside of his elbows with injection shots that were more than just the one final one, supposedly? And did they do that in the house? And there was some kind of a scene because Kurt finally realized what was going on. And then they went and cleaned up the house because it was never that tidy. And was his body brought up to the greenhouse and then, you know, the end.
That was the thing. Is there some video of this where you're looking at the house and I'm going, it doesn't even look like it's lived in.
No, not at all.
It's definitely not. And supposedly he's hanging around the house for days and days. And even the room that he dies in is not a mess. So here's the challenge I give to a listener. You go ahead and isolate yourself to one part of your house if you got multiple parts of the house, and live in that one area for like a week. right? Yeah. And don't really go outside. All right. Obviously, you got to use the bathroom or something. But I mean, you know, or maybe you pee in Snapple bottles, whatever. Point is, the whole place is too clean.
Yeah.
So who cleaned it?
And here's another thing. A few other people were in the house with Kurt as well. One notable one was Macaulay Culkin's half sister, Jennifer Adamson, who later on died in a weird situation in 1999, I believe. She was the girlfriend of the suspect I'm talking about. His best friend was also on the property. And the suspect that I'm talking about, his girlfriend, I can actually say what her name is, Jessica Hopper, because she ended up getting a nice cushy job at MTV News after that. And Geffen, by the way, like before that. She had mentioned in one of the Kurt Cobain official biographies, official because of Courtney, that she ended up, her boyfriend who was there, ended up dragging her away, and she's puking in the driveway because she's so upset, but she never goes into why she's puking and what did she see or hear that supposedly, you know, that made her have such a reaction. So to this day, you know, people question her at it because I guess she still does little things in the music industry, like Q&A sessions and stuff. And on YouTube, I think it's still there, where someone asks, like, what was going on the, you know, those final days of Kurt? Because she turns the tears on and all this other stuff, but she doesn't answer the question. You know, she kind of just does the, how dare you ask me that? You know, that type. I'm like, well, it's a legitimate question. What caused you to puke in Kurt's driveway? Like, what was going on there, you know?
Fair enough. Okay, well, is there anything else that we should touch upon here before we come to a conclusion? Because, man, there's a lot here, by the way.
Courtney's boyfriend right before Kurt, a guy by the name of Falling James, he was a singer in the 80s that she was kind of grooming to be a rock star and didn't end up being one. He had mentioned, I believe, in the Kurt and Courtney documentary from 1998 that she would have people, if he didn't do exactly what she would say, she would have paid guys to beat him up. And he also mentioned that to really, really stick it to him, that she ended up killing her fetus, guy's unborn child. So if that's true, I don't know. It says a lot about the personality, you know.
Well, look, there's a lot of, you know, sometimes people are complete, you know, psychos in one relationship.
And yeah, that's true.
You know, but this whole thing was, you know, toxic from inception. Again, you know, you combine that with Hank Harrison's story about how she was, you know, gonna kill a rock star eventually.
Yeah, she used to write in her notebooks as a child. Yep.
Yeah.
It's called Future Date. It was a poem she wrote. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, that was just one of the things that he said that, telegraphed that this was gonna happen. And of course, he stated that if it wasn't Kurt, it would have been somebody else. But
he also stated, and actually there was documents that were released last year that I didn't even know about. Documents released saying that Courtney was, in fact, related to the CIA in one way or another. Part of an operation where she would basically bring over thousands of tabs of acid over to the European music scenes and kind of pass them out in a way like, you know, like Manson did back in the day, you know, with his follower, you know, something like on the different scenes to get people kind of hooked, you know. So there's I think Hank actually referred to that because I think an ex-CIA guy that was friends with Hank confirmed that to him on his deathbed or something.
Well, and there's a whole lot to be said, and again, many grains of salt with Hank Harrison because, you know, no disrespect to the dead here, but fact is, I mean, the guy was the Grateful Dead's tour manager. They ditched him because, you know.
Very early on, too.
Yeah, I mean, he was a little too much for them, right? You know, you want to talk about the acid culture and passing it around. And meanwhile, I'm going to tell you that, you know, psilocybin in its natural form, I don't object to. But and the government starts, you know, putting it out there and purposely kneecapping the counterculture, which I'm satisfied they did, with it, anything can be weaponized, folks.
Yeah, but they also took the anti-war movement with them in the 60s by doing that, so it kind of sucks.
Well, yeah, there's a sidebar. But that wasn't even the whole thing. I think that there might have been a legitimate challenge to the status quo from the intellectuals at a certain point. And I don't,
I'm going by Dave McGowan here. That's where I'm getting my stuff from.
No, I got you, and that's fine. But you know, look, Dave went so far with certain things, and there's definitely other people to look at. I mean, if you look at John Potash's work on this,
I was just going to say that. That's actually John, the book that John Potash put out is basically the spiritual sequel to Weird Scenes Behind the Canyon or whatever, because Dave actually was asked in one of his last interviews if he would ever tackle the 70s, 80s, and 90s music scenes. Mm-hmm. And he said it was something to consider, but he wanted to tackle a few more topics first. So when John Potash put that out, it just reminded me of where Dave most likely would have went with that.
Right. I don't know if Dave would have gotten into the Tupac.
Tupac stuff, yeah. But Dave was a big fan of Alice in Chains, though, because he wrote about Layne Staley when Layne Staley passed, too. I was really surprised at that, and pleasantly surprised, because I like Dave's work, but the fact that he liked songs like Nutshell and stuff kind of touched me, you know?
Mm. Well, and, you know, to me, look, my favorite band of all time is always going to be Black Sabbath, but quite frankly, the most talented group that I ever saw, and the strongest hard rock group of any type that I ever saw, in my estimation, is Alice in Chains.
Oh, that's awesome.
And, they are certainly a unique thing that will never happen again without exactly the personnel that came together, even though there is an interesting replacement singer there continuing that on at the moment.
Yeah, it's not the same. It's like when Queen went on the road with the guy from American Idol. It's not the same.
Yeah, right. It's just, yeah, that's just, I mean, sorry, Freddie Mercury's gone, Queen is over.
A little sidebar, though. You know, I bring up Layne Staley. Layne Staley actually questioned if Kurt was a suicide or not, because Layne said in an interview in 1996 that the whole thing smelled rotten to him, because Kurt actually picked him up in that Volvo I was talking about and gave Layne a ride to like the supermarket or whatever about a month and a half before Kurt's body was found. And Layne said the whole ride there, he was talking about gushing about Francis Bean and everything, and how he was so happy being a father and everything. He found it very odd. And the two the go-between that Kurt had with Layne was Mark Lanegan of the Screaming Trees. Like, they were buddies. Like, all three of them were buddies, and unfortunately, they shared the same drug dealer. But Courtney actually called Layne's stepfather, Jim Elmer, when Kurt was missing, quote unquote, to ask if Layne knew what was going on or what Layne knew, and because of Mark Lanegan. So that I always thought was pretty odd, too.
Well, I never met Kurt, but I did meet Layne Staley, and
yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, but it seems like it's too personal and too sad.
It's a little touchy, but I'll tell you something. I never read the interview that you just cited.
Yeah,
but I know he said stuff like that, and it's weird because Screaming Trees, I thought nobody ever heard of them actually. For a long time.
Well, I always liked Nearly Lost You. I always thought it was a beautiful song, which actually Layne covered once. It's on video somewhere.
Yeah, well, it's odd, but when he's living in California at a certain point there, he did say something about that the first time I actually met him, I didn't talk to him because I ended up on the same stage with him in Jersey, but
yeah.
But the second time that I did, he had a lot of things to say about a lot of things. And honestly, at the time, I didn't take that seriously.
Yeah.
Cause it was mixed in with a bunch of other stuff Layne was saying.
Yeah, he was, full blown heroin user, and He probably just, looked like death too.
He was deteriorating. Know? I mean,
exactly. Yeah.
And I literally took it as the rantings of somebody that's, you know, I mean, I looked at when I left. I was in an apartment that was a complete mess, and I'm pretty sure it's the apartment he died in. And
all in the new district, right?
Yeah, I looked at the guy I left with, and I said, I very sadly just met a dead man because this guy was great, and he is, he's hardly even recognizable at all.
I talked to his mother, Nancy McCollum, and I asked if his demos and stuff, that his home demos that he would record by himself, if that and the manuscript that he was writing a novel, if any of that stuff survived. And she said no, all his so-called friends ransacked the place.
Well, when he was alive, stuff was being stolen from him.
Exactly.
And that's something I was privy to. His stuff was being lifted. And you know, some things, they wouldn't have had any monetary values if somebody wasn't selling them for drugs.
No.
You know, I mean, some people had said that he had sold everything he owned for, he didn't sell everything he owned for drugs.
He was still getting royalty checks because that was 2002. So Alice in Chains was still heavy rotation at that point.
Yeah, he definitely didn't sell everything off. But I mean, it was just like, people had stolen a bunch of stuff from him over the years, and it never resurfaced. He never could figure out exactly who it was. He had an idea about somebody who had ripped him off of a bunch of those tapes.
Yeah. And actually, his ex-bandmate, Mike Starr, who is no longer with us either, Mike Starr admitted to Nancy on that Celebrity Rehab show that he was with Lane in the hours before Lane passed. And Lane begged him not to call 911 or something like that. And he says, if you call 911, we'll never speak again. And I don't know. I don't know. He was like really sad. And I think Nancy actually, at first, I think the rumor was that people thought that, yes, Mike was there with him, but that Mike may have, this is speculation, may have stolen some things too. But we'll never know. We'll never know.
That's
what addiction does, you know. It's horrible.
Well, that's the thing is, you know, it was questionable as to whether he was keeping track of things or he was fully aware of what was going on sometimes. And unfortunately, that was the state he was coming in and out of. And I heard at certain points that he had actually been better and seemed like he was pulling it together. And then he would spiral back downward. I mean, it was a very back and forth sort of tug of war.
Chris Novoselic actually would go over and try to check on Lane too. So I always found that was, you know, very sad too, you know.
Well, I heard about it and I knew that he was dysfunctional enough that he wasn't going to like return to the music world very quickly.
He lost his teeth too at one point. So he didn't even really sound the same, like especially in the last three tracks that he ever recorded, which was the tracks Died. The Faculty soundtrack from 1999, it was like a super band with like Tom Morello and him, and it was called they did a cover of another Brick in the Wall Part 2, and they called themselves Class of 99, and he sounds haunting on it, but you can tell like he doesn't have his teeth anymore. Get Born Again was the last single he did with Alice, so.
Right. Well, look, all that stuff is yet again, and believe it or not, there's a whole, I mean, it's not about murder there, I don't believe. I do believe the man destroyed himself, but when it comes to Lane Staley. But there are a lot of questions about Kurt Cobain. I mean, was he on a destructive path? Could he have actually been responsible for it? Yeah, theoretically. I think so, but it's still an open question. And it's not just because, I don't want to believe that this guy couldn't have done it.
You're just playing devil's advocate because any of the detractors are going to pull up certain things and you want to be able to have the ammunition to back up your facts, you know?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, ultimately, not based on our conversation today necessarily, but I mean, ultimately, I think that there is something more to this situation at a minimum.
Yeah.
That we're not seeing. I don't know if he was positioned to do this, encouraged to do this, if somebody else pulled the trigger. I'm not certain. I just know that something is wrong with the story. And it could turn out that, there's a bunch of anomalous stuff here, and the guy decided to destroy himself. He had been notoriously unhappy about a lot of things.
But some people, but here's the thing. Some people that that used to be in his inner circle that saw him in the last month or two said that he was in high spirits. He had all these plans. I talked to Leland Cobain, Kurt's grandfather, in 2003. Talked to him on the phone. And he confirmed what was in the press, that he actually was supposed to go fishing with Kurt like the week after Kurt's body was found. Kurt and Michael Stipe were supposed to start recording like a White Album-esque type project in Georgia.
He wanted for a long time to record with Michael Stipe. So, I'm just explaining here that, look.
Sometimes suicidal people will make plans and appear very happy and still kill themselves. Yeah, there is that too.
Unfortunately, I have way too much personal knowledge of people who did this.
Yeah, me too.
And the fact is that, people go, oh, well, that's, look, people will read it different ways. A lot of times what you'll hear right after this happens is, I don't know why that happened. They seem so happy. Things were going good.
And sometimes that is the case. Sometimes what will happen is the person that they know they're going to die soon, so it's like, they have a weight lifted off their shoulder and they feel like they're finally going to have peace at some point.
Well, and there you go. And then they act contented and honestly,
almost happy, like smiling, like, cause I'm going to be out of this pain.
I'm going to do this. And so everything's cool. And I can make all the plans I want. It doesn't matter. Maybe I'll do it today. Maybe I'll do it tomorrow, but I'm settled on it. I think that's what happens, but you know what? There's nobody to ask when they succeed.
Yeah, there's no coming back,
And the truth is that some people see what they want to see. Yeah. And I'm talking about this about outsiders, and they go, well, they were happy, they were good, everything was good. You never actually know.
Oh, yeah. I know. I've put on a happy front so many times, and inside I was dying. Yeah.
I mean, look.
People wear masks.
But everybody does. Nobody shares everything that's in their head and in their heart with anybody. No matter how much you believe that happens in the most close personal person in your life, I assure you that there are things that are not being shared with you. And sometimes when people don't know how to articulate their pain, they don't know how to relate it. They don't think it'll be understood.
I can say from my own personal experience that I wouldn't want the person, a loved one to, be in that negative void with me. So I wouldn't even mention it.
Well, see, there is another motive. You know what? I'm miserable and if people don't want me to, you get punished for you're making other people miserable with your misery. Exactly. Well, okay. So maybe you shut up and then you just suck it in. And then that's it. And then you know what? After a little while, you go, okay, I'm going to make that decision. And like you said, all right, since I know my life's going to end soon, my misery's over.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, they seem happier. They seem lighter. But also, again, people see what they want to see, too. Sometimes they don't see things right in front of them. I mean, personal experience. I've had people where they've taken their life. You literally have two people that you think are in exactly the same proximity, should know this person inside and out, and they'll sit and say two totally different things.
Yeah.
Where, you know what? I knew this guy, or I knew this woman was miserable for a long time. I knew this was coming. I should have done something. I should have said something. You talk to somebody else equally as close.
Yep.
And they'll go, I don't understand this. This makes no sense. They seemed happy.
Yeah.
Sometimes
people will use that to their advantage, an already suicidal person, and use it in a crime, like a staged suicide scenario.
Well,
that happens all the time.
Well, see,
not
that's
the famous people necessarily.
When you got somebody, you go, look, man, this person was into self-harm. This person was into their drugs, whatever. More than one person has tried to OD somebody on purpose because, well, they were a drug addict. They OD'd.
Yeah.
And
it's like Seattle PD, open and shut. They didn't care.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm just saying that to me, it's an open question still.
Idea is to try to get the death certificate changed from suicide to undetermined, because there's enough there for some other investigative body to be able to open it. I just don't know if they ever will.
Right. So I'm going to close this out, Chris, by saying that there is actually a change.org. Now, I'm not usually into these petitions, but there is.
I'm not either. But this is really close to my heart. So I know what you mean, though. Some people start a change.org thing to change the flavor of donut at Dunkies. You know what I mean? But, you know.
No, but there is literally a change.org petition out there, which is to change the official conclusion to open an investigation to change the official conclusion from suicide to undetermined. And
it can't happen. Look at Natalie Wood like that. That proves it right there.
Yeah. No, definitely. But I'm just saying it's out there. I'm going to include a link with the show notes. And if Chris decides to give me any links to go along with some of the information he shared, that's what we'll do as well. So that's the end of this hour.